On this edition for Sunday, December 16th, a partial government shutdown looms over funding of the border wall. A look at life inside ISIS from a reporter on the front lines. And in our signature segment, rising seas and a mass exodus. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
From the Tisch WNET studios at Lincoln Center in New York, Hari Srinivasan.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. Federal agencies are preparing for a partial government shutdown at the end of the week if Congress doesn't meet Friday's midnight deadline. At issue is paying for a wall on the Mexican border. Democratic leaders say there are not enough votes to pass a bill with President Trump's requested $5 billion to build a wall the president claimed during his campaign Mexico was going to pay for.
We shouldn't shut down the government over a dispute.
Last Tuesday, President Trump publicly sparred with top Democrats over the potential shutdown. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said they offered to keep funding for border security at $1.3 billion.
In the House or the Senate, he is not going to get the wall in any form. Even the House, which is a majority Republican, they don't have the votes for his $5 billion wall plan. And we should not let a temper tantrum, threats, push us in the direction of doing something that everybody, even our Republican colleagues, know is wrong.
White House senior advisor Stephen Miller said the Trump administration will not back down.
We're going to do whatever is necessary to build the border wall to stop this ongoing crisis of illegal immigration.
And that means
this is a very fundamental issue.
The father of the 7-year-old Guatemalan girl, Jacqueline Call, who died while in the custody of U.S. Border Patrol agents, is disputing statements by authorities that his daughter had not had any food or water for several days before crossing into the United States. Ruben Garcia, director of Annunciation House, a nonprofit group that assists migrant families where Kyle's father is now staying, read a statement yesterday from attorneys for the family.
She and her father sought asylum from Border Patrol as soon as they crossed the border. She had not suffered from a lack of water or food prior to approaching the border.
Jacqueline Call and her father crossed the U.S. border in New Mexico illegally with a group of more than 160 other migrants on December 6th. According to the Washington Post, she died December 8th from dehydration, shock, and liver failure. The Department of Homeland Security has launched an internal investigation. Hundreds of protesters in Lebanon marched through the streets of Beirut today to rally against a government stalemate. Political factions remain divided, leaving Lebanon without a government 7 months after elections. Demonstrators are upset by corruption, poor public services, and a rising public debt that has grown to 150% of Lebanon's GDP. Today's rally was organized by the country's Communist Party. The Indian-administered section of Kashmir was hit today by both a government security clampdown and a strike led by separatists. The moves are in response to the deaths of 7 civilians and 4 combatants yesterday when government forces fired at anti-India protesters during a gun battle. India and Pakistan each administer a section of Kashmir, but both claim the disputed region, which has led to decades of violence. For more on today's top stories, visit us online at facebook.com/newshour. There's a growing population of migrants in this country coming not across the southern border, but from island nations in the equatorial Pacific. They're fleeing deepening poverty and the destructive effects of climate change, and they enjoy a status in America unlike that of any other immigrant group. Special correspondent Mike Taibbi reports from the Marshall Islands and Salem, Oregon. This report is part of our ongoing series Chasing the Dream and was funded in part by Pacific Islanders in Communications.
In snapshots, the Marshall Islands look like paradise, a Pacific archipelago of coral atolls midway between Hawaii and Australia. But what pictures don't tell you is that a third of the island's population has left for the United States. And why leave their island home? The president of the Marshall Islands, Dr. Hilda Heine, explains.
There have been people who leave for education, for health purposes, for jobs. And I'm sure there are people who are leaving because of the threats of climate change.
Climate change is a big issue here. Much in the news recently as punishing king tides combined with persistent drought have wreaked havoc on dwindling freshwater supplies. The view among climate experts, and many here who keep rebuilding their seawalls against the warming, rising Pacific, is that the islands are sinking, if not disappearing.
So, of course, people are looking for better things, and they think that anything in the United States is better than what we have here. We're competing with the strongest country in the world.
There's another reason they're moving to the United States, where the Marshallese community currently numbers around 30,000. Citizens of the Marshall Islands can live and work in the U.S. without visas and work permits. That's because of a 1986 law called the Compact of Free Association, or COFA. COFA established U.S. economic aid and special rights for a trio of equatorial Pacific Island nations used by the U.S. military, including for the scores of nuclear tests in the 1940s and 50s that rendered some of the Marshall Islands, like Bikini Atoll, uninhabitable. Today, with good jobs in short supply on the Marshall Islands, unemployment is hovering around 40%, leaving for America makes sense for many.
Okay, and the next placement of concrete, not tomorrow.
American Jerry Kramer's company, Pacific International, has been here for half a century and is the country's biggest private employer. He says that so many people have moved away that it's a struggle to hire and hold on to skilled local workers.
You employ hundreds. How many have you lost to migration to the States?
I'm afraid to guess.
Over the years, hundreds?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Recent years, many more?
Without a doubt. Most of our Marshallese are either very young or very old. The more productive ages, between 25, 45, there's a smaller percentage because both of those people go.
Isaac Marty told us his $4 an hour newspaper job barely paid for food, making leaving the islands the only option to make sense.
I love the islands. This is where I grew up. I was born and grew up, and I don't want to leave the islands, but then I have no other choice but to try to make some living for my family.
But moving from here is expensive. So his wife Amelia and two of their kids were the first to leave in April of last year for Salem, Oregon, while Isaac and his son Isaiah stayed behind, bunking with relatives. There are nightly calls to Amelia in Salem, not knowing if it'll be months or years before they'll all be reunited. In the meantime, at Isaiah's school, 80 kids didn't show up on opening day because they and their families had left.
We start at 2:45.
And many of his remaining classmates can't afford school supplies. Poverty has a huge impact on education throughout the islands. Also limited, medical care here. No kidney dialysis, no cancer care. Even basic care is in short supply. Isaac Marty found himself frustrated, whether it was one of the kids needing treatment for an ailment or his wife Amelia battling chronic depression.
We don't get that quality service that we want. We get sent away with pills and other medication that does not help most of the time. So that's, to me, that's awful.
Finally, 5 months after Amelia and the other kids had left, Isaac and Isaiah were able to join the rest of the family in Salem after relatives already in the States helped pay for their airfare.
When the Marshallese come here to Oregon, the state of Washington, Arkansas, places where their numbers have increased exponentially in recent years, they're not citizens, they're not illegal or undocumented immigrants, they're not refugees shielded by temporary protective status, they are what many are now calling permanent non-immigrants.
Among them, Jesse Gasper, one of the first to arrive 3 decades ago, who came here under COFA years after his grandparents and great-grandparents had been relocated from Bikini Atoll due to the nuclear testing of the early 50s. Gasper spent his childhood in Arkansas, which has the largest population of Marshallese living in the U.S.
In elementary school, I cried a lot. Yeah. You know, I cried a lot when I was going home because I was different.
What, were you ever confronted with outright racism or discriminatory language?
All the time. All the time. I learned to, I guess, be a politician. So I try to be pleasing to everybody.
Gasper and his family eventually settled in Salem, where he works as an insurance agent. He's also the president of an advocacy group called the Oregon Marshallese Community.
When somebody comes here from the islands, they expect to have this Hollywood-type lifestyle. And when they do come here, they're faced with rent, they're faced with a job that doesn't sufficiently pay for all the bills that they, you know, have.
He spreads the word about resources available to the community, the churches where hundreds of Marshallese flock on Sundays.
But these are the reasons why we've migrated here.
And he meets with city officials like Mayor Chuck Bennett.
So I'm hopeful that everything's going well.
Casper talks about the challenges facing his fellow islanders. Since they're not citizens, they can't vote. And in Oregon, have only recently gained access to benefits full citizens enjoy, including health care options and jobs in fields like law enforcement. And they're still seeking access in other areas like food stamps and in-state college tuition discounts. But this genial city of 170,000 has made adjustments for the swelling population of Marshallese and other Pacific Islanders.
Numbers are growing. Currently, there's over 1,600 Pacific Islanders in our school district, which is a pretty big number. I make sure that they're getting what they need and their voices are heard.
With so many Pacific Islanders in its school district, Salem employs Kenny Ramirez as a resource specialist, now working exclusively with that community.
They're coming to school a little tired because they couldn't even start their homework till after the youngest siblings were in bed.
Sure.
Our absentee rate for our Pacific Islanders is high. Our graduation rate is not the greatest right now. So that's one of our major focuses. I need to listen to them and find out what the underlying reason is why they're not at school first, because there's usually a bigger reason to why they're not at school. It could be transportation. It could be home situation.
It's a 24/7 job, building relationships with parents through home visits.
I've already spoke with the teachers, and they said that he's doing his best.
And connecting with kids one-on-one.
So great job with that.
Either in school, where he tracks their attendance and grades.
You know, your grades are great. We have one class of concern.
Or in the Pacific Islander Club, whose meetings, a junior named Rose May told us, are always packed. The aim here is to create a sense of community and to preserve a Pacific Island culture that goes back thousands of years.
Rose May, how important is it to have a club like this?
To me, it's like really important. It's like my own little island here in this classroom.
During our visit, the kids talked about the difficulty of trying to embrace an American-styled adolescence.
Did you find it a struggle to just show up at school?
I wasn't used to here. It was confusing at first. Middle school year, I never came to school because I was just too scared.
Some in this club are determined to someday visit.
I haven't been to Marshall Islands or anything.
If not moved to the Marshall Islands. Will the islands be there as a place to live? If you ask President Hilda Heine, and we did, she'll insist the Marshall Islands are not done yet.
I hope that, you know, people will see that the Marshall Islands as a country and as a people continue to live and continue to exist, that we didn't abdicate and just say forget it and leave.
There are efforts here to create more opportunities in the islands, but they have limitations. This processing and packing plant serves the world's biggest tuna fishery that produces millions in licensing fees yearly for foreign boats. But there's still no full-service harbor here that would allow the Marshallese to support their own fleet of tuna boats and to catch the fish themselves. This aquaculture fish farm operation produces more than a ton of the fish delicacy called moi each week, but it isn't profitable yet and currently employs fewer than 50 islanders. And this workshop trains youth in carpentry, crafting the sailing canoes that for a millennium have explored these islands. But those lovely canoes aren't a business so much as an act of devotion. As for Isaac Marty, he and his son Isaiah have been living in Salem, Oregon for more than a year now, this reunited family striving to be self-sufficient in a new city. They spend afternoons at a sun-splashed nearby park. They have a decent used car, a new apartment, and just enough money for food and a few toys for the kids.
You're doing a great job.
Isaac himself has landed his best job yet, $17 an hour as a much-in-demand translator for the school district.
Yeah, I've got, I think, about 5 more syllabus to work on.
Yes. Okay.
And his kids are thriving in school.
The workload that they give to elementary school students here are like the workload that they give to middle schools back home. They're getting smarter. I feel that they're getting smarter than me.
So she's 8 pounds, 7 ounces.
And there's a new baby in this family, Petunia.
36 centimeters.
She gets regular neonatal checkups through Oregon's health plan. And the doctor also checks in with mom, Amelia, to make sure that her anxiety and depression are under control.
Mood is okay.
not getting too sad or worried?
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit.
Well, we get a little bit up to like near boiling point and then just calm down a bit, yeah.
Isaac tries not to second-guess the decision he made to leave the Marshall Islands.
It's like two things pulling you from like different directions. I got the islands and then my family. So I had to let one go so that I can have the other one.
U.S. military officials announced Saturday that efforts to fight the Islamic State in eastern Syria are nearing an end. This after U.S.-backed Syrian forces captured the town of Hajin, which is one of the largest urban enclaves controlled by the Islamic State in the region. But as we reported on this program, despite efforts to quell the growth of ISIS, strongholds are regrouping and localized groups are emerging as recruiters exploit the war and political factors. I recently sat down with New York Times foreign correspondent Rukmini Callimachi, who covers ISIS. Her in-depth podcast, Caliphate, takes listeners inside the terror group and their motives through her relationship with self-described former ISIS member Abu Huzaifa. You had a 10-part podcast series that looked at so many different layers of ISIS. And for people who might go back and subscribe now but didn't hear it then, what were you trying to accomplish?
I mean, grosso modo, I was trying to accomplish what I'm always trying to accomplish, which is I'm trying my best to understand these people that in many ways look like monsters to us. These are people that are doing acts that we consider so horrific that it's hard to even conceive of them as human. Mm-hmm. And yet, I've been on this beat now for 4 years. And as a result of my work, I've over and over had a chance to speak to them, mostly in jails in Iraq and Syria, but occasionally in the West, which was the case of Abu Huzaifa, who is the Canadian recruit who agreed to speak to us. And what strikes you when you speak to these people is just how normal they come across. And I'm trying to go as deeply as I can into the ideology that makes them tick, because we typically don't talk about that in an effort to not, you know, give it more oxygen. But unfortunately, it's important to try to understand it if we're going to try to stem the growth of this group.
How did you get this beat? Did you opt in? Did your editors work? I mean, when you first you joined the Times, what, a few years?
2014.
Right.
So it's been almost 5 years. I really just happened upon it. It was back when I was at the Associated Press. I was back then the West Africa bureau chief for the AP. In 2012, a group that was affiliated with Al-Qaeda took over the north of Mali. And very quickly, that became the most important issue on my beat. I was being asked to file on that all the time. In 2013, French forces went in to flush them out. I followed behind them, and that was the first major discovery of documents that I made. I realized that this is a group. Al-Qaeda, just like ISIS, is a group that is highly organized. It has an enormous amount of paperwork to go along with the bureaucracy that it is trying to run. And I realized then in 2013 that much of what Washington sources from the Pentagon to the State Department had told me about this group was wrong, was dead wrong. And I realized at that point in time that there was something that I could contribute to the study of this phenomenon.
As you see people that are in this world, I remember one of the things that was kind of at the end of your podcast, I mean, you caught up with this a year later, the same story, whether or not this individual was gaming the system.
Yes. Huzaifa and I and our team spoke to each other over the course of a year and a half. And we got to him in what I think was this really critical moment, which was that he had managed to get back to Canada without getting arrested. He got through the airport, no issues. So he thought he was scot-free. Nobody had come to interrogate him. And he was starting to think real hard about the awful things that he told us he had done. He claimed that he was so upset by some of them that he could no longer sleep. He was sleeping on the floor next to his mother's bed. And so I think we caught him in this moment of what seemed like true remorse. Immediately after we interviewed him, 12 hours later, police come and bang down his door. He then starts this year-long process of constant interrogations, constant surveillance. He would come out of his house and see a car parked there. He would get in his own car. That car would come behind him. And so he suddenly went from, I'm scot-free, and which gave him the space to sort of feel guilt, to these jerks are after me, you know, like, how dare they, how, you know, I was just doing my duty as a Muslim, and these crazy things that he tells himself, right? And then when they couldn't file charges against him, this arrogance came out that you see in the final
episodes,
this boldness, this, you know, they can't get me, I'm, you know, I'm free, check it out, you know, I've gamed the system. It was a really bad look, and I told him as much, you know, I kept on trying to push him on this and say, like, listen, like, you have talked about killing two human beings. What about their families, right? What about their families? And he would always sort of shut down when we went back to that. Beyond that first period of time, he did not want to talk about the murders again.
In his brain, and probably the brains of lots of these people, they think they are on the side of good.
Absolutely.
The rest of us perceive this, we hear their words,
right,
and we say, what are you talking about, right?
The critical experience that Huzaifa had that propelled him towards this group was him in front of his computer in his bedroom at his mom's house watching and rewatching these horrific YouTube videos of Syrian civilians being killed in airstrikes. These images cause all of us pain. But at the moment when he was ingesting those images, he was also speaking to ISIS recruiters who were saying, these are Muslims who are being killed by the West. Of course, they're being killed by barrel bombs by Assad,
right,
in their own country, but they gloss over that. These are Muslims that are being victimized by the West. You are one of their Muslim brothers. It is your duty to help them. And then at a certain point, he bought their rationale and found himself, you know, in what was their self-proclaimed caliphate, yeah, standing behind a Muslim man about to shoot him to death.
All right, Rukmini Callimachi, The New York Times. You can see her reporting on the website as well as listen to the podcast Caliphate. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hari, thank you for having me.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Sunday.
Space travel. It appears to be getting closer for us mere civilians. Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2 successfully made it to space this week. The ship went more than 50 miles up on Thursday morning. That's the Federal Aviation Administration's definition of space. The flight is a major milestone in commercial space travel, and it's the first manned American ship to make it to space since the space shuttle was retired in 2011. The company says nearly 700 people are on a waiting list to get on board. Tickets aren't cheap. It would be $250,000 for the ride. And Virgin is not alone. Blue Origin, the rocket company founded by Jeff Bezos, said its first test flights with passengers could take place as soon as 2019. And Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, is planning a commercial flight around the moon by 2023. But there is a dark side of the moon, if you will. Earlier this week, NBA superstar Steph Curry was a guest on the Winging It podcast with fellow NBA players Kent Bazemore, Vince Carter, and Andre Iguodala. And he expressed doubt that the U.S. ever landed on the moon.
We ever been to the moon?
Nope.
Nope. They're going to come get us. I don't think so either.
Beautiful. Just beautiful.
Of course, despite what some people believe, 12 American astronauts did walk on the moon between 1969 and 1972. And the Trump administration says that going back is a priority. The backlash to Curry's conspiracy talk was, well, immediate. NASA even offered to take the two-time MVP on a tour of its lunar lab the next time he's in Houston. And it turns out, Curry says he doesn't need convincing after all. He told reporters on Wednesday that he was just joking about the moon landing being faked and that he's excited to take NASA up on its offer to visit. It was a full moon turnaround for one of the NBA's brightest shining stars.
Finally, tonight, a fifth person has died as a result of the shooting at the Strasbourg, France Christmas market last Tuesday. The 36-year-old Polish-born man had been in a coma since the attack. Hundreds gathered at a makeshift shrine near the Christmas market today to honor the victims of the mass shooting. And tomorrow on the PBS NewsHour, we'll report on a troubling outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Have a good night.